Welcome to Linux Link Radio by TimeSys, the podcast for embedded Linux developers.
Okay, so welcome to Linux Link Radio by TimeSys, a podcast for embedded Linux developers. My name is Maciej Halasz. I'm on the product management team, and with me here is Gene.
Hi there.
Today, we're going to cover a number of topics. This is our third episode. We got some feedback from some of you asking us to do a bit of introduction as to what we're going to talk about, and we'll actually come back to that list of things that we talked about at the end. So, Gene, you want to cover what we're going to talk about today?
I mean, that sort of implies we know what we're going to talk about before we start.
Yeah.
And then we have some ability to remember it long enough to wrap it up at the end. But no, I mean, today we're going to talk about getting things like the host environment set up if you've just uncrated your board or open up the wrapper on your board. And as we go through that, we're going to sort of discuss what works well, what doesn't work very well. I know we're going to touch on Cygwin as well. We do have a lot of folks out there that do their development on Windows. And if you want to be successful in doing that at all, you typically use Cygwin, which is like this nice POSIX emulation layer. I mean, one of the nice things, not to get too far off topic, but you know, one of the great things about Cygwin is that once you install it on your system and you get that bash shell, you're at least freed from using the standard Windows command line prompt, which is pure evil compared to what Cygwin has to offer.
Absolutely. So let's start with talking about a bit of setup that's going on around a Linux distribution of any kind when you try to get it installed on a host machine. But before we get to that, we should probably talk about a bit more about our assumptions. And the assumptions are that there is a target platform that customer can connect to.
Yeah.
That the target platform comes with some sort of a bootloader. We're not going to talk today about how to get a bootloader on the card. That may be actually a good topic for another session.
That would be. I mean, that's a half an hour to 45 minutes right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And on the host side, our assumption is that there is either Linux or Windows-based machine that has enough disk space, of course.
Yes. Yeah. So for the BSD and Mac OS X guys, I'm sorry. We might get a little bit close, but
Maybe one day.
Yeah, maybe one day.
Okay, so on a host machine, there's several. After you install the distribution of any kind, you want to be able to get some of the content of that distribution that you installed on a host machine across the network to your target platform. For that, there are unfortunately or fortunately some services that have to be put in place, and those services would greatly vary based on specific deployment scenario or how you want to work with the target.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but there's definite commonalities. I mean, most boards will download their kernel via TFTP, which, depending upon your distribution, and actually most distributions don't have TFTP installed by default. You need to go out and get whatever packaging system that your board happens, you know, your distribution has to be using, and install TFTP. That's usually the one that trips people up. And then, you know, of course, if you're doing anything that uses a remotely mounted root file system, it's going to be done via NFS, the network file system. And that's usually installed. I mean, most people have NFS.
Yes, and what's actually interesting about the TFTP service is that even though it's installed, on most Linux systems, it's disabled by default.
Oh, yeah, that's right, because it is quite insecure.
Exactly. So you have to edit the specific file under etc subdirectory, change a configuration option from disabled yes to disabled no.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the inverse logic has tripped up I don't know how many people. At least 50% of the people call in, and that confuses them right off the bat because they see the word yes, and they think, hey, it's enabled. And no, I mean, the flag says disabled. I mean, even though they read it disabled, and it's interesting. You know, the other thing talking about security is that one of the safest things you could, well, not safest, but one of the fastest ways to get your system set up is simply to turn off the firewall. I have untold number of folks that are out there, and they have a computer that's behind a firewall at work, and always goes out through some proxy, but they're still running the default firewall that ships with their desktop Linux distribution. But most of the time, I think Red Hat or Fedora Core have that firewall. It's really tight turned on, and so as a result, the user will get everything set up correctly, and the board will try to connect and via TFTP, and only two ports are open on that machine.
And there's no clear indication of what the problem is. So you have to know where to look and what to pay attention to go around this particular issue.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's totally silent because TFTP is never invoked, and it's not as though otherwise the system would be completely overwhelmed that the firewall logs rejected connection attempts. I guess, it's the same thing. I guess you probably could configure it to do it that way. But that's sort of that just seems more trouble than it would be worth.
Yeah.
Especially for standard
more time.
Yeah, distribution.
Yep. So TFTP is one of the services that you usually have to have in place just to get a binary Linux kernel across the network to the target platform. Mm-hmm. But once you have the kernel on the target and you start booting it, there are other services that you need to have set up on your host machine for that image to work correctly.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, you need your TFTP. Your DHCP server and NFS, and then depending upon if what you're booting, a lot of x86 boards boot using PXE.
Yep.
So you need to have a PXE service running, and getting those set up is one of those things. When we look at people and look at people's usage patterns, takes them sometimes longer than anything else in the process.
Yes.
In fact, one of the things that we notice is, you mentioned board startup and DHCP. Another classic stumbling block we get is folks will get their board up and running, and then all of a sudden they'll have it set up with a static IP address, and then they'll set it up so that it queries for one. And then they get some random address, and they don't understand why that's happening, because they have the DHCP server running, and they have it running with the correct parameters, and they believe they set up the .conf file to respond to the MAC address, and they have everything right. And you know what? They do. Yep. The problem is they don't understand that the DHCP protocol is a first response wins. So what happens is that their machine usually gets beat by whatever's running out on the campus.
Yep.
And that's... that's an unfortunate thing to run across because it seems so mysterious.
Yep.
And that's one of the reasons why we recommend that you splurge for the whole $19 and get a get another Ethernet card and dual home your machine.
Yep.
Because that way you can run, and even if you're really cranky about your firewall, and if at work they have fairly difficult measures with respect to your firewall, at least you can turn off your firewall on the second adapter and leave that one open and just run your boards on some network, some other network.
There will be no confusion from the from target standpoint as to what IP address it gets and what subnet it lives on.
Yeah.
And DHCP works much cleaner. However, this is all assuming that you have access to the target right on your desk. In many situations, you have a target platform sitting in some lab. You can connect to that lab from your host machine, from your desk machine.
Yeah.
But in such environment, you have a clearly defined subnet where you can put the target platform on.
Yeah, the playground.
And that becomes a bit more tricky, but that varies so much that there is no one approach that we could explore here that would help out users.
Well, fortunately, companies that find themselves in that position usually have, I would say in all cases I've encountered, have very competent IT staff.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're able to do something like publish a little board bring up guide, and the instructions to do things are really well done so that you know the parameters of the playground and then how to set things up so that you don't cause any problems.
And this is actually a very, very good setup because it's secure.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows how to get there. And if you have an IT person that can put up a README on how to connect to those target platforms for you,
you're
all set.
Yeah.
So we talked about NFS service. We talked about DHCP service, and you can start it either as part of a system or you can start it on a specific Ethernet interface as a daemon.
Yes.
And that way you can narrow down the specific adapter, Ethernet adapter, that DHCPs are sent to.
Yes. Yeah, so you can do things both, because I guess the other funny thing about that is that if you're not, you know, dual-homed, or sometimes you end up serving Ethernet, you end up serving DHCP addresses against your campus network,
right.
Which is kind of funny until the IT people show up, and then for some reason they don't find it all that funny. But that's a definite thing. You set that up with, there's an environment variable, it's called DHCP args, and it's usually, I know Red Hat Systems, it's in the files, you put, there's a DHCPD file inside of etc sysconfig, and you can put DHCP args equals and the name of the adapter, and then the right thing will happen when you restart the service, and that will save you a lot of effort. Yep. You know, another configuration thing, I guess when we're talking configuration and security that would make minimal amount of security is, you know, we find out that people look at the NFS. So if you remotely mount your file system, of course you have to have an export in your NFS. /etc/exports has some NFS directory in there that you need to export to, or you need to export. And what I found is the users will go through a lot of effort to set that up correct. They'll put in only the IP addresses that are allowed to contact. They'll fill in just the exact directory that needs to go to. And when I see those are the people that generate usually the most amount of requests for help, because things don't match over time. And so that's one of the things for NFS is usually the simpler you make it, the better. If you just make it, forget about specifying IP address, just put a star there and export the top level of your root file system. So a lot of people store the root file system in their op directory. So all you have to do is export /opt, and you've automatically exported everything underneath /opt. And that way, if you add another file system, you don't have to. It makes life a lot easier.
I agree with you 100%. And if you, especially if you have multiple root file systems on the same host machine, and you have different targets that want to connect to that to those different root file systems, especially that you can use the DHCP. Daemon to serve a specific location on your host machine that the target platform is going to use to mount the root file system over the network.
Yeah.
So that part is already serviced by DHCP. So from the NFS standpoint, exporting the entire root file system makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it does make your life a lot easier.
There are some interesting things about setting up NFS service, though. There are several services that have to be started, and they have to be started in a specific order.
Yeah.
There is the NFS lock service that you have to start first, followed by NFS start or restart, if you like. But That's confusing to many of our customers. Mm-hmm. They don't pay attention to which service gets started first, and then they see different problems on the target because of target not being able to mount root file system via NFS.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's the classic. And the other thing, too, is if you ever get nine-tenths of the errors that you get out of NFS on the target, very difficult to debug. They really aren't very informative. Most of them boil down to two big causes, right? Can't contact the machine, and if it can't contact the machine, it can't mount the
permissions.
The correct mount point because of permissions. And that's where I found for all the crazy things you can try to do to diagnose that, if you do a tail-f on var log messages, NFS is wonderfully verbose. And it'll tell you whether a board is making contact, and if a board is making contact, it'll tell you what it was trying to mount and why it failed. And it usually has to do with permissions.
And exactly the same actually applies to DHCP. If you don't know the MAC address of your target platform, but you sit on a dedicated subnet, what you can do is you can start DHCP daemon, power up your target platform, and look into var log messages for requests for IP address, and usually you will see a MAC address of a target platform that requests the IP address.
Oh yeah, matter of fact, for how lazy I am, I just simply cut and paste. I crank up the board, let DHCP deposit that in var log messages, because I run it tailf in an XTERM window, and just cut and paste it and put it in my file and make it easy on myself. It's a huge time saver. But you know, the other thing too, I guess while we're sort of digging down there, the other variant of questions or problems you run into is whenever you don't get anything in Barlog Messages, you start your board up and nothing happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, for that, I found, you know, for myself, I use TCP dump, and you can turn on TCP dump on a certain adapter, which is really great if you have a dual home machine. That's why having a dual home machine makes life easier for you. So that $19, good idea. And then you can turn on for a certain adapter, and then you can watch the traffic come across the network. I don't know how many times people have set their machines up, they turned off their firewall manually, right? They stop the firewalling service. And if you're using a Red Hat machine, you use the check config, right? So someone will run check config, or someone will just have turned the firewall off, and then they then start it up, they restart their machine for whatever reason, and then their firewall starts up again, and they forgot that they stopped their firewall, and then their board doesn't boot. And these folks, you talk to them, and sometimes the best way to diagnose that is to simply look at TCP dump and see what's coming across. Because if it's been stopped by the firewall, you know, TCP dump won't produce any output, and you'll know instantly that you have a problem.
Yep.
Now, that's when it gets into things. Whenever you're turning these services on and off, if you have a Fedora core-based distribution, there's a great program called check config, and you can say check config TFTP on, check config, you know, I even forget what the firewall is because I haven't turned mine on in so long. But you can turn that service off as well. And that way it'll persist in between reboots of your host.
This is one way of actually bringing up Linux kernel on target platform, but in scenarios where you're ready to deploy or you can live with a small footprint design, you don't need all the libraries, you don't need native compilers on your root file system. One way of going about booting Linux on a target platform is to simply use a JFS2 formatted root file system, small footprint root file system that can live either in onboard flash or in memory.
Yeah.
And in such situations, you don't have to necessarily worry about all those services that we talked about. You don't have to worry about DHCP necessarily. You can assign a static IP address. You don't have to set up an NFS service. And, well, if you can work with that small image, small root file system / kernel, that's probably the fastest way of getting Linux kernel to boot.
Yeah, well, I know one of the things we changed with our, because we have these various number, of course, these marketing people dream up one per day, right? But we have these various number of evaluation programs. And one of the things that we changed, and of course this took like a week to explain to someone so they understood it, is that we made the root file system to be completely contained. And so all you had to really do is with TFTP load up the root file system onto the board, and then it would boot independent. It wouldn't need the DHCP address. It wouldn't DHCP for anything. Wouldn't need NFS. But you're right. I mean, if you do happen to get, and I know times has n many number of distributions like that, but if you do happen to get a distribution similar to that that doesn't have any dependencies, that'll whack out a lot of the effort that you have to do in order to get your machine set up. But you're right. I mean, there is sort of like a trade-off there because you won't have all the functionality. Because the other thing is that the NFS mounted root file system are typically, you know, everything in the kitchen sink and times two.
Well, it's geared towards people that want to develop applications.
Oh, yeah.
People that have high requirements for libraries, people that have high requirements for compilers, utilities. And also, when you work with the NFS mounted root file system, you can simply copy executables on your host machine, which might serve also a purpose of being your development system.
Oh, yeah.
You can copy those executables from one directory to another, and they would just show up on a target root file system. That accelerates a bit your testing phase, and you can very quickly verify that whatever you're working on, application, kernel module, everything is just working well.
Yeah, plus it means when you accidentally turn your board off, you don't lose a lot of the configuration stuff you put on there as well.
Including your log files.
One of my famous stunts. I shouldn't admit to that, but I do it more than I do it more than I should.
So we spend a lot of time talking about all those different services, talking about how to bring up Linux on a target platform, but we haven't really talked about Cygwin yet. In case a developer is faced with Windows as an operating system for bringing up Linux kernel on target platform or developing an application, there's one way of there's one solution to basically work with the GNU tool chains and other open source packages, and the answer is Cygwin, which is really a shell that allows you to execute Unix commands, and utilities take advantage of Linux libraries under Windows.
Well, it's great. I know for one of the things that TimeSys did is we put a lot of effort into making sure that people could do the same sort of development work in the same way on Cygwin, and even bring up a board. And we had an engineer here that did a lot of work on getting the NFS server to operate on Windows. So there is NFS services if you want to mount up your mount things up that way. And at the same time, with Cygwin, you can also have it set up so that it'll start via the Windows services, different kind of service. But via the Windows services, other things, it'll start up a port map, and it'll have a crude sort of XINET D service running if you want to run Cygwin's TFTP.
You can also run DHCP.
So
all those services that we talked about so far, you can deploy them equally under Windows. And that's, as you said, one of the things that our engineers have optimized for our customers. And we have a number of documents that talk about how to set those services up under Cygwin. Because the truth is, it's far more complex than the setup of those services under Linux.
Oh, yeah. And they run a lot slower, too. I know that the NFS under Cygwin it doesn't quite perform the way it does under Linux. I'll put it that way. It's not speedy by all means. One of the things that I recommend for folks is that if they're going to use Linux, they at least go out and get the SolarWinds TFTP server. Mm-hmm. Which is a really great, it's just a little Windows application, runs in user land, and you can point it to where your TFTP directory is. And users seem to have a lot less trouble with that. It's it's a free software. I think if you just use that Google thing, right, and look for SolarWinds TFTP, you'll find it.
And especially in a scenario where you, again, work with a small footprint design, mm-hmm. The contained image that includes Linux and root file system, if you have that TFTP server that you were talking about, that's all you really need. Because you avoid setting up the port map, the setting up the NFS, DHCP. You can follow the route of setting the target as a static box and just...
Yeah, we have more users than you think that from an engineering discipline's point of view, they build their system... Whenever they do a compiler or anything like that that they do testing on, they build the system right down to the root file system image that they put on the board. And they try to avoid doing things like remote mounts because they notice that it changes the way they think about their target board. And it also introduces additional assumptions that they sometimes later have to wring out. And so by doing it that way, they sort of set themselves up and so that the concept of the board's going to be running remote and it's this file system is something that they're constantly thinking about, opposed to something that they sort out at the end of the process. Yeah. So I guess along with making a decent technical decision, it's also a fairly good managerial decision as well, a process type decision.
There are some challenges around the services or how you start those different services under Cygwin. Uh-huh. For example, when you look into a service panel under Windows, usually you see whether a service is started or whether it stopped. In case of port map and services that you start for Linux purposes, like DHCP and NFS, mm-hmm. Windows is not good in reporting the actual status of those utilities. So in some cases, you can see under Windows service panel that the service is not running, but in fact, it's running. And another way of finding that out is simply going to your Cygwin shell and finding out whether a specific SigDrive process is executing.
Yeah, Yeah, there is an analog in Windows. In fact, if you go to Varlog messages, it's not. Unfortunately, one of the things the geniuses at Sigmund haven't done is created something that dumps that out.
Yeah.
That would be really great because it's a segue, but you know, sorry to segue, but I was using, because I'm a big Sigmund user, and you know, there's a clipboard device in Sigmund.
Seriously?
So, yeah, there's /dev/clipboard. Hmm. And you can, you know, cat something to dev clipboard and then control V it. Or I thought to myself,
FLP.
These guys are smarter than you can imagine. You know, so it was. But one of the things that they haven't implemented is something that lets you dump out the Windows event log.
Mm-hmm.
But you can open up. I've always opened up by hitting the Windows key and R for run, and it's Event Viewer, EventVWR, and just press enter, and you'll see an Event Viewer.
Say it again.
Oh, slower. So, EVENT, V is in Victor, W is in, W. And then R's and Robert.
Okay.
Event Viewer. And you can pop that up and you can look at... It's not as same and it's not as comprehensive and it doesn't work as well as what's available with Varlog messages in Linux. But it certainly is something.
Yeah.
It certainly is something.
Yeah. Well, in any case, if you can avoid playing with those services under Windows, I would strongly recommend you do that.
Yeah.
Because beginning from setting up of those services all the way through working with them, most likely you will experience more challenges than with working with a Linux host machine.
Yeah. Matter of fact, we even recommend to some of our customers that have Windows shops to again go out and either rescue some PC from the garbage heap, just to use it to host the board, to do the initial work to get the board up and running, because it is that much easier. I'm not saying that Sigmund is inferior by any means, but it's simply a lot easier if you have that Linux host to get that initial board set up.
We covered actually the setup of your host machine and target a bit. Well, maybe we didn't talk enough about the target. The heart of the entire process for the target is really a bootloader. And depending on the target platform that you work with, if that's a PowerPC board, you would, in most cases, end up working with a bootloader called U-Boot.
Uh-huh.
And on X-Scale's ARM platforms, you would find either U-Boot or Red Boot from Red Hat.
Okay. And then, of course, you have the ubiquitous x86 bootloaders as well, right?
I forgot almost about that, yes. The PXEs and...
They have PXE, and then the way the BIOS works on x86, you can always, you know, put Lilo or Grub on your boot sector and have that bootload for you.
So a lot of... the complexity of the entire process depends partially from how good the bootloader is.
Mm-hmm.
If the bootloader has some problems with TFTP or downloading the image from the target platform, timing out, then there's a problem, right? If the bootloader doesn't have or can't store environment variables, you'll end up typing in your commands every single time you want to boot the platform.
Oh, come on, Masha. You open up gedit or VI and you stick them in there.
How annoying is that?
Right? Everyone out there has VI or what? Open another window that has their cache of commands they cut and paste.
Well, but in most cases, what you want to do is set up the target platform to auto boot and just reset the power on it, and don't worry about Linux coming up on it. You just want to have your entire development environment ready for your application.
You don't mean you don't like typing load RBEO?
Of course I don't.
Yeah.
What was that address again? That happens to me every single time I work with a different board.
But I do agree. I mean, that's really great. And that's one of those things that I know we did our other Linux yesterday, today, tomorrow, but that's one of the things that has improved substantially in bootloaders is their scripting capabilities at startup. Mm-hmm. And that's a treat. I mean, it really is a treat in that you can set your board up that it'll start reasonably. You usually build it in so it'll pause a few seconds while you're doing your dev work, and it takes a lot of effort out of takes a lot of effort out of getting your board started. So unless you like to type that.
There's actually one pitfall that some of the users run into, which is when you boot the Linux kernel with those bootloaders, each Linux kernel has a command line or kernel command line where you pass different parameters to the kernel. For example, how you set up the initial console and how you set up an IP address, the kind of root file system that you want to mount. If you use a bootloader with defined boot arguments, they tend to overwrite the settings that you have built into your kernel.
Yeah.
So you have to be very careful when you get a new board that... take a look at your environment variables and make sure that the boot arguments in the bootloader match your requirements, because they will take the precedence over the arguments that are built into the kernel.
Yeah, I agree. It is a little bit too helpful, and that's another one of those things where you really don't think about the bootloader switching things around, and then you're on another hour-long goose chase for sort that out. So we're getting waved at by the guys. We have someone here that helps us, and he said, "Hey, you're over.
Happens.
You're
again.
Over. You have to watch." So I do know that there are some things that we've been doing a couple of these so far, and we had some people come in with some comments. So again, thanks for writing in. We appreciate your writing. I know one of the things that we've been working on is making the voice quality better. And I know that we have someone here, his name is Alex, that does the post-production work. And I know he's been working really hard to make sure things sound as good as they can, given the constraints that we have for our podcast. But if you want to send us notes, you can always send us a note at podcast@timesys.com, or you can visit us at timesys.com. And I think if you go to lldn.timesys.com, I wonder, it would be really nice if we just had one web address, wouldn't it? I think if you visit us at lldn.timesys.com, there's a podcast button on there, too, where you can leave some notes. So, again, we sincerely hope that the audio quality is better this time around.
I would like to actually, at the end, also recap what we talked about.
I told you we wouldn't forget.
I know that you told me. So today we talked about... what it takes to set up a host environment, both on the Linux and Windows side. And we covered a bit of the complexities around getting the Linux kernel up and running on a target.
Yeah. And well, there's three tips to remember there, right? First is turn off the firewall, right? Yep. Second is go to Fry's or wherever, spend $19 on another Ethernet card,
yep,
and dual home your machine. And third is look in Verilog messages.
Very helpful, yes.
It's the big three. If you remember those three things, most of your other problems should, I shouldn't say they go away, but at least it would be easier to find. And then we also had some other questions that related a little bit to what people wrote back for other webinars. We had one guy that who wrote in and said, hey, what about different languages on targets now. Seems like embedded is moving away from just C, and I know that's one of the things that I think we want to talk about. It's an interesting topic because at this point, embedded devices are powerful enough that it's not unreasonable that you use Python, yeah, or Java or Perl or any other number of languages that would have just given a old-time embedded engineer conniption fit.
And as a matter of fact, they are all included in our default development root file system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess the little mini replies, yeah. We know we know our customers are out there using TCL and Lisp on their target machines, and I think we should probably spend some time to talk about what the state of that is and what the state of the art is and what we see people out there using, what we see them successful with.
I agree with you 100% that we should take that as a input for our planning of next podcasts turn that into a separate episode, perhaps.
We also get questions, too. You're probably better talking about this than me, Jake, about. So the question is always, well, I want to do a, you know, multimedia device, and I want to have a screen, and I wanted to update, and, you know, I wanted to show video. What processor should I use?
Well, there are so many processors on the market these days. There's a DaVinci, a famous DaVinci processor from TI.
Oh, yeah.
There are new processors coming from manufacturers like Freescale and Atmel, for that matter. They all are very interesting. They integrate new features. They are more powerful. Some of those processors, they implement the new ARM 11 core.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of advancements, but if you're looking for a processor for your next project, you can definitely visit one of our websites, LLDN. We keep a bit of information on the processors that we provide Linux links for. And we provide a bit of description of what the peripherals of that particular processor and how you can use it. One of the latest Atmel processors, for that matter, is very interesting. It comes with an integrated, on reference platform LCD displays. It comes with a sound chipsets. It's all in one small little package that you can very easily take advantage of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, what we'll try to start doing from now on is between the regular episodes, podcast episodes, we'll try to have a much shorter episodes where we would introduce the new processors that we get to work with, where we could talk a bit about what those peripherals on system on chips are and how people can leverage those features in their own designs.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be a little bit better, I think, sometimes in the press release. Because I know we issue a press release and we stick out a page that describes what the processor does. But we do have a lot of folks that just like to, it's easier for them to listen.
Audio press release.
Yeah. So it's a little bit easier for them to process that way. Hey, there's one other, we actually got it from a few folks, and it has to do with somewhat related to processor is, I want my Linux distribution to be small. How small can it be? You guys sort of talked about that in your presentation, and I do know we have we will be doing a small fruit file system webinar in the future. As a matter of fact, we're going to be at the CLF show in San Jose, and Times is going to be doing a talk on making a small root file system. Along with the webinar. I think we have a webinar on that topic, too. But we'll set up a podcast for that, because there's a lot of tips and techniques and strategies and some things that are very common sense that you can do that you can really take a lot of space out of your root file system.
Yep. We can easily spend an hour talking about it or more. But that's going to be a very interesting episode, so I would like to invite everybody to it already today.
Yeah, and like I said, thanks for listening in. It says questions or comments, you can send them to us at podcast@timesys.com or visit us at lldn.timesys.com. Right on the front page when you log in, there's a listen to our podcast. It's easy. There's an icon of a guy with big elephant ears. You can click on that, and you'll see. I know we have some episodes. We have at least, I think, 3 episodes on there now. Yep. And there's even a very interesting interview with Thomas Glexner.
Yeah,
that does the real-time work on the 2.6 kernel. So again, thanks. And
thank you very much.
This podcast was brought to you by TimeSys. Check out our new site to get free code, discuss, and learn about embedded Linux development. Go to timesys.com today.